I arched an eyebrow at him. You're bailing on your client? Just like that? Accomplice is an ugly word. So is penitentiary. Smart kid. Smarter than I had been when I first got my PI license. I need to know who backed you. Graver thought about that one for a minute, then he said, No. Why not? I make it a personal policy not to turn on clients or piss people off who are into murder. You lost the work, I said. What if I made it up to you? Maybe you didn't read that part of the book. The I in PI stands for investigator, not informer. Well, maybe I call the cops. Maybe I tell them you're involved in the attacks. Maybe you can't prove a damn thing. Graver shook his head. You don't get ahead in this business if you can't keep your teeth together. I leaned back in my seat and crossed my arms, studying him for a moment. You're right, I said. I can't make you, so I'm asking you, please. He kept on staring out the windshield. Why are they after you? I'm protecting a client. Old guy in the wheelchair. Yeah, Graver squinted. He looks like a hard case. You have no idea. We sat in the air conditioning for a moment, then he glanced at me and shook his head. You seem like a reasonable guy, Graver said. Hope you don't get dead. Conversation over. I thought about pushing things, but I'd been around long enough to recognize someone who was genuinely tough-minded when I see him. You got a business card? He reached into his shirt pocket and produced a plain white business card with his name and a phone number. He passed it over to me. Why? Sometimes I need a subcontractor. He lifted both eyebrows. One who knows how to keep his teeth together. I nodded to him and got out of the car. I leaned down and looked in the door before I left. I know a mechanic. I'll give him a call and he'll come on out. He's got a compressor on his truck and he can fill up your tires. I'll pay for it. Graver studied me with calm, intelligent eyes and then smiled a little. Thanks. I closed the door and thumped on the roof with my fist. Then I walked back to my apartment. Mouse, who had waited patiently in the yard, came shambling up to greet me as I stepped out of the street, and he walked alongside me as I went back to the apartment. Morgan was lying on my bed again when I came back in. Molly was just finishing up changing his bandages. Mister watched the entire process from the back of the couch, his ears tilted forward, evidently fascinated. Morgan nodded to me and rasped, Did you catch him? Yeah, I said. A local PI had been hired to keep track of me, but there was a problem. What's that? I shrugged. He had integrity. Morgan inhaled through his nose and nodded. Pretty rare problem. Yeah, impressive young man. What are the odds? Molly looked back and forth between us. I don't understand. He's quitting the job, but he won't tell us what we want to know about his client because he doesn't think it would be right, I said. He's not willing to sell the information either. Molly frowned. Then how are we going to find out who is behind all of this? I shrugged. Not sure, but I told him I'd get someone to come by and put the air back in his tires. Excuse me. Wait, he's still out there? Yeah, I said. Blue Mercedes. And he's a young man? Sure, I said. A little older than you. Name's Vince Graver. Molly beamed. Well, then, I'll go get him to tell me. She walked over to my icebox, opened it, pulled out a dark brown bottle of microbrewery beer, and walked toward the door. How are you going to do that? I asked her. Trust me, Harry. I'll change his mind. No, Morgan said fiercely. He coughed a couple of times. No! I would rather be dead, do you hear me? Be dead than have you use black magic on my behalf. Molly set the beer down on the shelf by the door and blinked at Morgan. You're right, she said to me. He is kind of a drama queen. Who said anything about magic? She pulled one arm into her t-shirt and wriggled around a little. A few seconds later, she was tugging her bra out of the armhole of her shirt. She dropped it on the shelf, picked up the bottle, and held it against each breast in turn. Then she turned to face me, took a deep breath, and arched her back a little. The tips of her breasts pressed quite noticeably against the rather strained fabric of her shirt. What do you think? She asked, giving me a wicked smile. I thought Vince was doomed. I think your mother would scream bloody murder, I said. Molly smirked. Call the mechanic. I'll just keep him company until the truck gets there. She turned with a little extra hip action and left the apartment. Morgan made a low, appreciative sound as the door closed. I eyed him. Morgan looked from the door to me. I'm not dead yet, Dresden. He closed his eyes. Doesn't hurt to admire a woman's beauty once in a while. Maybe, but that was just wrong. Morgan smiled, though it was strained with discomfort. She's right, though, especially with a young man. A woman can make a man see everything in a different light. Wrong, I muttered, just wrong. I went to call Mike, the mechanic. Molly came back about 45 minutes later, beaming. Morgan had been forced to take more pain medication and was tossing in a restless sleep. I closed the door carefully so that we wouldn't wake him. Well, I asked. His car has really good air conditioning, Molly said smugly. He never had a chance. Between two fingers, she held up a business card like the one I'd gotten. I did the same thing with mine, mirroring her. She flipped hers over, showing me a handwritten note on the other side. I'm worried about my job as your assistant. She put the back of her hand against her forehead melodramatically. If something happens to you, whatever will I do? Wherever shall I go? And? She held out the card to me. And Vince suggested that I might consider work as a paralegal. He even suggested a law firm, Smith Cohen McElroy. His job-hunting suggestion, eh? I asked. She smirked. Well, obviously, he couldn't just tell me who hired him. That would be wrong. You are a cruel and devious young woman. I took the card from her and read it. It said, Smith Cohen McElroy, listed a phone number, and had the name Evelyn Derrick printed under that. I looked up to meet Molly's smiling eyes. Her grin widened. Damn, I'm good. No argument here, I told her. Now we have a name, a lead. One might even call it a clue. Not only that, Molly said, I have a date. Good work, Grasshopper, I said, grinning as I rolled my eyes. Way to take one for the team. Chapter 22 Smith, Cohen, and McElroy, as it turned out, was an upscale law firm in downtown Chicago. The building their offices occupied stood in the shadow of the Sears Tower and must have had a fantastic view of the lake. Having plucked out the enemy's eyes, so to speak, I thought that I might have bought us some breathing space. Without Vince on our tail, I hoped that Morgan could get a few hours of rest in relative safety. I'd figure out somewhere else to move him, just as soon as I leaned on Ms. Evelyn Derrick and found out to whom she reported Vince's findings. I guess I looked sort of mussed and scraggly, because the building security guard gave me a wary look as I entered solidly in the middle of lunch hour. I could practically see him deciding whether or not to stop me. I gave him my friendliest smile, which my weariness and stress probably reduced to merely polite, and said, Excuse me, sir. I have an appointment with an attorney at Smith Cohen and McElroy. They're on the 22nd floor, right? He relaxed, which was good. Beneath his suit, he looked like he had enough muscle to bounce me handily out the door. 24, sir. Right, thanks. I smiled at him and strode confidently past. Confidence is critical to convincing people that you really are supposed to be somewhere, especially when you aren't. Sir, said the guard from behind me, I'd appreciate it if you left your club here. I paused and looked over my shoulder. He had a gun. His hand wasn't exactly resting on it, but he'd tucked his thumb into his belt about half an inch away. It isn't a club, I said calmly. It's a walking stick. 6 feet long. It's traditional Ozark folk art, with dents and nicks all over it. I thought about it for a second. I'm insecure? Get a blanket, he held out his hand. I sighed and passed my staff over to him. Do I get a receipt? He took a notepad from his pocket and wrote on it. Then he passed it over to me. It read, Received 1 6-foot traditional Ozark walking club from Mr. Smartass. That's Dr. Smartass, I said. I didn't spend 8 years in insult college to be called Mr. He leaned the staff against the wall behind his desk and sat back down at his chair. I went to the elevator and rode up. It was one of those express contraptions that goes fast enough to compress your spine and make your ears pop. It opened on the 24th floor, facing a reception desk. The law office, apparently, took up the entire floor. The receptionist was, inevitably, a young woman, and just as unavoidably attractive. She went with the solid oak furnishings, the actual oil paintings, and the handcrafted furniture in the reception area, and the faint scent of lemon wood polish in the air, variations on a theme of beautiful practicality. She looked up at me with a polite smile, her dark hair long and appealing, her shirt cut just low enough to make you notice, but not so low as to make you think less of her. I liked the smile. Maybe I didn't look like a beaten-up bum. Maybe on me it just looked ruggedly determined. "I'm sorry, sir," she said, "but the Addiction Counseling Center is on 26. Sigh. "I'm actually here to see someone," I said, "assuming that this is Smith Cohen and McElroy." She glanced rather pointedly, but still politely, at the front of her desk, where a plaque bore the firm's name in simple sans-serif lettering. "I see, sir. Who are you looking for?"
"Ms. Evelyn Derrick, please."
"Do you have an appointment?"
"No," I said, "but she'll want to talk to me."
The receptionist looked at me as though she had some kind of bitter, unpleasant taste in her mouth. I timed my arrival correctly then. The young lady clearly would have been much more comfortable handing me off to a secretary or executive assistant or whatever you're supposed to call them now, and letting someone else decide if I was supposed to be there. And Ms. Evelyn Derrick's assistant was just as clearly out to lunch, which was the point of showing up during lunch hour.
"Who shall I say is here?"
I produced Vincent Graver's business card and passed it to her. "Please tell her that Vince has acquired some unexpected information and that she needs to hear about it." She pushed a button, adjusted her headset, and dutifully passed on the message to whoever was on the other end. She listened and nodded.
"Straight back down the hall, sir, the second door on the left."
I nodded to her and walked through the door behind her. The carpet got even thicker and the decor more expensive. A nook in the wall showcased a small rock fountain between a pair of $2,000 leather chairs. I shook my head as I walked through a hall that absolutely reeked of success, power, and the desire for everyone to know about it. I bet they would have been seethingly jealous of the ostentatiatory in Edinburgh. I opened the second door on the left, went in, and closed it behind me to find a secretary's desk, currently unoccupied, and an open door to what would doubtless be an executive office appropriate to the status of Evelyn Derrick, attorney at law.
"Come in, Mr. Graver," said an impatient woman's voice from inside the office. I walked in and shut the door behind me. The office was big, but not monstrous. She probably wasn't a full partner in the firm. The furnishings were sleek and ultra-modern, with a lot of glass and space-age metal. There was only one small filing cabinet in the room, a shelf with a row of legal texts, a slender and fragile-looking laptop computer, and a framed sheepskin from somewhere expensive on the wall. She had a window, but it had been frosted over into bare translucency. The glass desk and sitting table and liquor cabinet all shone, without a smudge or a fingerprint to be seen anywhere. It had all the warmth of an operating theater. The woman typing on the laptop might have come with the office as part of a complete set. She wore rimless glasses in front of the deepest green eyes I had ever seen. Her hair was raven black and cut close to her head, showcasing her narrow, elegant features and the slender line of her neck. She wore a dark silk suit jacket with a matching skirt and white blouse. She had long legs, ending in shoes that must have cost more than most mortgage payments, but she wore no rings, no earrings, and no necklace. There was something cold and reserved about her posture, and her fingers struck the keys at a rapid, decisive cadence, like a military drummer. She said nothing for 2 full minutes, focusing intently on whatever she was typing. Obviously, she had something to prove to Vince for daring to intrude upon her day.
"I hope you don't think you can convince me to rehire you, Mr. Graver," she said, eventually, without looking up. "What is it that you think is so important?"
Ah, Vince had quit already. He didn't let much grass grow under his feet, did he? This woman was evidently used to being taken very seriously.
I debated several answers and decided to start things off by annoying her. I know, me. Shocking, right? I stood there treating her the same way she treated me, saying nothing, until Evelyn Derrick exhaled impatiently through her nose and turned a cool and disapproving stare toward me. "Hi, Cuddles," I said. I'll give the lady this much. She had a great poker face. The disapproval turned into a neutral mask. She straightened slightly in her chair, though she looked more attentive than nervous, and put her palms flat on the desktop. "You're going to leave smudges," I said. She stared at me for a few more seconds before she said, "Get out of my office." "I don't see any Windex in here," I mused, looking around. "Did you hear me?" she said, her voice growing harder. "Get out." I scratched my chin. "Maybe it's in your secretary's desk. You want me to get it for you?" Spots of color appeared on her cheeks. She reached for the phone on her desk. I pointed a finger at it, sent out an effort of will, and hissed, "Hexus!" Fouling up technology is a fairly simple thing for a wizard to do, but it isn't surgical in its precision. Sparks erupted from the phone, from her computer, from the overhead lights, and from something inside her coat pocket, accompanied by several sharp popping sounds. Miss Derrick let out a small shriek and tried to flinch in three directions at once. Her chair rolled backward without her, and she wound up sprawled on the floor behind her glass-topped desk in a most undignified manner. Her delicate-looking glasses hung from one ear, and her deep green eyes were wide, the whites showing all around them. Purely for effect, I walked a couple of steps closer and stood looking down at her in silence for a long moment. There was not a sound in that room, and it was a lot darker in there without the lights. I spoke very, very quietly. "There are two shut doors between you and the rest of this office, which is mostly empty anyway. You've got great carpets, solid oak paneling, and a burbling water feature out in the hallway." I smiled slightly. Nobody heard what just happened, or they would have come running by now. She swallowed and didn't move. "I want you to tell me who had you hire a detective to snoop on me." She made a visible effort to gather herself together.
I don't know what you're talking about."
I shook my head, lifted my hand, and made a beckoning gesture at the liquor cabinet as I murmured, "Forzare," and made a gentle effort of will. The door to the cabinet swung open. I picked a bottle of what looked like bourbon and repeated the gesture, causing it to flit from the opened cabinet across the room to my hand. I unscrewed the cap and took a swig. It tasted rich and burned my throat pleasantly on the way down. Evelyn Derrick stared at me in pure shock, her mouth open, her face whiter than rural Maine. I looked at her steadily. "Are you sure?"
"Oh, God," she whispered.
"Evelyn," I said in a chiding voice, "focus. You hired Vince Graver to follow me around and report on my movements. Someone told you to do that. Who was it?"
My clients," she stammered. "Confidential."
I felt bad, scaring the poor woman. Her reaction to the use of magic had been typical of a straight who had never encountered the supernatural before, which meant that she probably had no idea of the nature of whoever she was protecting. She was terrified. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to hurt her, but I was the only one in the room who did. The thing about playing a bluff is that you have to play it all the way out, even when it gets uncomfortable. "I really didn't want this to get ugly," I said sadly. I took a step closer and put the bottle down on the desk. Then I slowly, dramatically raised my left hand. It had been badly burned several years before, and while my ability to recover from such things was more intense than other human beings, at least in the long term, my hand still wasn't pretty. It wasn't quite horror movie special effects anymore, but the molten scars covering my fingers, wrist, and most of my palm were still startling and unpleasant if you hadn't ever seen them before.
"No, wait," Evelyn squeaked.
She backed across the floor on her buttocks, pressed her back to the wall, and lifted her hands.
"Don't!"
"You helped your client try to kill people, Evelyn," I said in a calm voice.
Tell me who. Her eyes widened even more.
What? No. No, I didn't know anyone would get hurt.
I stepped closer and snarled.
Talk! All right, she stammered.
She stopped speaking as suddenly as if someone had begun strangling her. I eased up on the intimidation throttle. Tell me, I said, more quietly. Evelyn Derrick shook her head at me, fear and confusion stripping away the reserve I'd seen in her only moments before. She started shaking. I saw her open her mouth several times, but only small, choked sounds emerged. Her eyes lost focus and started flicking randomly around the room like a trapped animal looking for an escape. That wasn't normal. Not even a little. Someone like Evelyn Derrick might panic, might be cowed, might be backed into a corner, but she would never be at a loss for words. Oh, I said, mostly to myself. I hate this crap. I sighed and walked around the desk to stand over the cowering lawyer. Hell, if I'd have known that someone had... I shook my head. She wasn't really listening very hard to me, and she'd started crying. It was one of about 1,000 possible reactions when someone's free will has been directly abrogated by some kind of psychic interdiction. I just created a situation in which every part of her logical, rational mind had been completely in favor of telling me who had hired her. Her emotions had been lined up right behind her reasoned thoughts, too. Only, I was betting that someone had gotten into her head. Someone had left something inside her that refused to let Miss Derrick speak about her employer. Hell, she might not even have a conscious memory of who hired her, despite the fact that she wouldn't just hire some detective to spy on somebody for no reason. Everyone always thinks that such obvious logical inconsistencies wouldn't hold up, that the mind would somehow tear free of the bonds placed upon it using those flaws. But the fact is that the human mind isn't a terribly logical or consistent place. Most people, given the choice to face a hideous or terrifying truth, or to conveniently avoid it, choose the convenience and peace of normality. That doesn't make them strong or weak people, or good or bad people. It just makes them people. It's our nature. There's plenty to distract us from the nastier truths of our lives if we want to avoid them. Evelyn Derrick, I said in a firm, authoritative voice. Look at me. She flinched closer to the wall, shaking her head. I knelt in front of her, then I reached out to touch her chin and gently lifted her face to mine. Evelyn Derrick, I said in a gentler voice. Look at me. The woman lifted her dark green eyes to mine, and I held her gaze for the space of a long breath before the soul gaze began. If the eyes are the windows to the soul, then wizards are the soul's voyeurs. When a wizard looks into another person's eyes, we get to see something of that person, a vision of the very core of their being. We each go through the experience a little differently, but it amounts to the same thing. A look into another person's eyes gives you an insight into the most vital portions of their character. Evelyn Derrick's deep green eyes almost seemed to expand around me, and then I found myself staring at a room that was, if anything, almost identical to the woman's office. The furniture was beautiful and minimalistic. Ms. Derrick, it seemed, was not the kind of person to overly burden her soul with the care and mementos most people collect over the course of a lifetime. She had devoted her life to her mind, to the order and discipline of her thoughts, and she had never left herself much room for personal entanglements. But as I stared at the room, I saw Ms. Derrick herself. I would have expected her in her business clothing, or perhaps in student's attire. Instead, she was wearing... Well, she was wearing very expensive, very minimalistic black lingerie. Stockings, garters, panties, and bra, all black. She wore them, very well. She was kneeling on the floor, her knees apart, her hands held behind the small of her back. She faced me with her lips parted, her breath coming in quickened pants. I was able to change my viewpoint slightly, as if walking around her, and those green eyes followed me, pupils wide with desire,
her hips shifting in little yearning rolls with every tiny correction of her balance. Her wrists were bound behind her back with a long, slender ribbon of white silk. I caught a motion in the corner of my eye, and I snapped my gaze up to see a slender, feminine form vanish into the corridors of Evelyn Derrick's memory, showing me nothing more than a flash of pale skin and a gleam of silver eyes. Son of a bitch. Someone had bound up Ms. Derrick's thoughts, all right, and woven those restraints together with her natural sexual desire to give them permanence and strength. The method and the glimpses I'd seen of the perpetrator, flashes of memory that had managed to remain in her thoughts, perhaps, gave strong indicators as to who was responsible. A vampire of the White Court. And then there was a wrenching sensation, and I was kneeling over Evelyn Derrick. Her eyes were wide, her expression a mixture of terror and awe as she stared up at me. Oh, yeah. That was the thing about a soul gaze. Whoever you look at gets a look back at you. They get to see you in just as much detail as you see them. I'd never had anyone soul gaze me who didn't seem disconcerted by the experience. Evelyn Derrick stared at me and whispered, "Who are you?" I said, "Harry Dresden." She blinked slowly and said, her voice dazed, "She ran from you." Tears started forming in her eyes. "What is happening to me?" Magic that invades the thoughts of another human being is just about as black as it gets, a direct violation of the laws of magic that the wardens uphold. But there are gray areas, like in any set of laws, and there are accepted customs as to what was or was not allowed in practice. There wasn't much I could do for Evelyn. It would take a hand lighter and more skilled than mine to undo the harm that had been done to her mind, if it could be undone at all. But there was one thing I could do for her, a bit of gray magic that even the White Council acknowledged as an aid and a mercy, especially for those who had suffered the kind of psychic trauma Evelyn had. I called up my will as gently as I could, and reached out with my right hand. I passed my fingertips gently over her eyes, causing her to close them. And as I passed my palm from her forehead down to her chin, I released that will with as much care as I possibly could, murmuring, "Dorme dormius, Evelyn. Dorme dormius." She let out a little whimpering sound of relief, and her body sagged to the floor in sudden and complete relaxation. She breathed in deeply once, exhaled, and then passed into simple and dreamless slumber. I made her as comfortable as I could. With luck, when she woke, she would pass most of our confrontation off as a bad dream. Then I turned and left the law office behind me, quiet anger growing inside me with every step. I went by the security guard at the door as the anger started nudging over into fury. I slapped the receipt down on his desk, and with a gesture and a muttered word, caused my staff to leap from where it had been leaned against the wall and into my hand. The guard fell out of his chair, and I left without looking back. The White Court was involved. They were trying to get Morgan killed, and me with him. And what's more, they were preying on people in my town, ripping into their psyches and inflicting harm that could blossom into madness given the right circumstances. There was a broad difference between their usual predation and what had been done to Evelyn Derrick. Someone was going to answer for it. Chapter 23. I got back to my apartment, shouldered open my door, and found a bizarre tableau. Again. Morgan lay on the floor about 5 feet from the bedroom door. He'd apparently seized my walking cane from the old popcorn tin by the door, where I keep things like Ozark folk art carved quarter staves, blasting rods, umbrellas, and so on. The cane was an old Victorian-style sword cane. You twist the handle and pull, and you can draw a slender 30-inch spring steel blade from the wooden cane. Morgan had. He lay on his side on the floor, his arm extended up at about a 45-degree angle, holding the sword. Its tip rested against Molly's carotid artery, just under her left ear. Molly, for her part, leaned back against one of my bookcases, her knees bent a little, her arms spread out to either side, as if she'd stumbled over something, and flung out her hands to brace herself against the bookcase as she fell back. To the left of the door, Mouse crouched with his fangs bared and resting lightly against Anastasia Lucio's throat. She lay on her back, and her gun lay on the rug-covered floor, about 2 feet beyond the reach of her hand. She appeared to be quite relaxed, though I couldn't see much of her face from where I stood. Mouse's deep brown eyes were focused steadily on Morgan. Morgan's steely gaze was locked on Mouse's jaws. I stared at them aghast for a minute. No one moved, except Mouse. When I looked at him, his tail wagged hopefully once or twice. I blew out a heavy breath, set my staff aside, and plodded to the icebox, stepping over Anastasia's leg on the way. I opened it, considered the contents for a moment, and then pulled out a cold Coke. I opened it and took a long drink. Then I picked up a dry kitchen towel, went to the couch, and sat down. "I would ask what the hell happened," I said to the room at large, "except that the only one with any sense who witnessed it can't actually talk." I eyed the dog and said, "This had better be good." Mouse wagged his tail tentatively again. "Okay," I said, "let her go." Mouse opened his jaws and sat up and away from Anastasia at once. He immediately padded over to me and leaned against me as his gaze flicked from Anastasia to Morgan and back. "Morgan," I said, "ease off the psycho throttle a little and put down the sword."
"No,"
Morgan said in a voice half strangled with fury. "Not until this little witch is bound and wearing a gag and a blindfold." "Molly's already done duty as a beer calendar model today," I said. "We're not dressing her up for a BDSM shoot next." I put the Coke down and thought about it for a second. Threats weren't going to have any effect on Morgan, except to make him more determined. It was one of the charming side effects of having such a rigid old-school personality. "Morgan," I said quietly, "you are a guest in my home." He flashed me a quick, guilty glance. "You came to me for help, and I'm doing my best. Hell, the kid has put herself into harm's way trying to protect you. I've done everything for you that I would have done for blood family, because you are my guest. There are monsters from whom I would expect better behavior, once they had accepted my hospitality. What's more, they'd give it to me." Morgan let out a pained sound. Then he turned his head sharply away from Molly and dropped the sword at the same time. The steel of the blade chimed as it bounced off the thin rug. Morgan settled into a limp heap on the floor, and Molly sagged, lifting her head and covering the vulnerable skin of her throat for a moment. I waited until Anastasia sat up to toss her the towel I'd brought from the kitchen. She caught it, her expression neutral, and lifted it to begin drying her neck. Mouse is a great dog, but he has to work hard to control his slobber issues. "So, I take it things almost devolved into violence again," I said to them, "and Mouse had to get involved." "She just came walking in here," Molly protested. "She saw him." I blinked and looked at her.
"And you did what, exactly?"
"She blinded me," Anastasia said calmly, "and then she hit me." She lifted the towel and wiped at her nose. Some blood came away, though most of it stayed crusted and brown below one nostril. So they hadn't been in the standoff for long. Anastasia gave Molly a steady gaze and said, "She hit me like a girl. For goodness sake, child, have you had no combat training at all?"
"There's been a lot of material to cover," I growled.
"Blinded you?" "Not permanently," Molly said, more sullenly now. She rubbed at the knuckles of her right hand with her left. "I just kind of veiled everything that wasn't her." "An unnecessarily complicated way to go about it," Anastasia said primly.
"For you, maybe," Molly said defensively. "Besides, who was the one on the ground getting pounded?"
"Yes, you're 40 pounds heavier than me," Anastasia said calmly.
"Bitch, I know you didn't just say that," Molly bristled, stepping forward with her hands clenched.
Mouse sighed and heaved himself back to his feet. Molly stopped, eyeing the big dog warily.
"Good dog,"
I said, and scratched Mouse's ears. He wagged his tail without taking his serious brown eyes from Molly.
I had to stop her, Molly said. She was going to report Morgan to the wardens.
So you physically and magically assaulted her, I said.
What choice did I have?
I eyed Morgan, and you staggered up out of bed you're supposed to be staying in, grabbed the first pointy thing you could reach, and forced her off of Anastasia. Morgan eyed me wearily.
Obviously.
I sighed and looked at Anastasia. And you thought the only solution you had was to take them both down and sort everything out later, and Mouse stopped you.
Anastasia sighed. There was a blade out, Harry. The situation had to be controlled.
I eyed Mouse, and you wound up holding Anastasia hostage so Morgan wouldn't hurt Molly. Mouse ducked his head.
I can't believe I'm about to say this, I said. So think real careful about where this is coming from. Have you people ever considered talking when you've got a problem?
That didn't please anybody, and they gave me looks with varying degrees of irritation mixed with chagrin. Except for Mouse, who sighed and said something like, a woof. Sorry, I told him at once. Four-footed, non-vocalizing company accepted.
She was going to get the wardens, Molly said. If that happened before we proved who really killed Lafortier, all of us would be up the creek.
Actually, Anastasia said, that's true. I turned my gaze to her. She rose and stretched, wincing slightly.
I assumed, she said quietly, that Morgan had recruited your apprentice to assist him in his escape scheme, and that they had done away with you.
I made a small, frustrated sound.
Why the hell would you assume something like that?
She narrowed her eyes as she stared at me.
Why would Morgan flee to the home of the one wizard in the council who had the most reason to dislike him? She asked. I believe your words were, that would be crazy.
I winced. Ouch.
I said, yeah, you lied to me, she said in a level tone.
Most people probably wouldn't have noticed the undertone of anger and pain in her voice, or the almost imperceptible pause between each word. I could see bricks being mortared into place behind her eyes, and I looked away from her. The room was completely silent until Morgan said, in a small and broken voice,
"What?"
I looked up at him. His hard, sour face had gone gray. His expression had twisted up in shock and surprise, like that of a small child discovering the painful consequences of gravity for the first time.
"Anna?" he said, almost choking on the words. You think that I... How could you think that I would...
He turned his face away. It couldn't have been a tear, not for Morgan. He wouldn't shed tears if he had to execute his own mother. But for a fraction of a second, something shone on one of his cheeks. Anastasia rose and walked over to Morgan. She knelt down by him and put her hand on his head.
"Donald," she said gently. "We've been betrayed by those we trusted before. It wouldn't be the first time."
"That was them," he said unsteadily, not looking up. "This is me."
She stroked his hair once.
"I never thought you had done it of your own free will, Donald," she whispered quietly. "I thought someone had gotten into your mind, held a hostage against your cooperation, something."
"Who could they have held hostage?" Morgan said in a bitter voice. "There's no one, for that very reason, and you know it."
She sighed and closed her eyes.
"You knew his wards," Morgan went on. "You've been through them before, often. You opened them in under a second when you came in. You have a key to his apartment."
She said nothing. His voice turned heavy and hollow.
"You're involved with Dresden."
Anastasia blinked her eyes several times.
"Donald," she began.
He looked up at her, his eyes empty of tears or pain or anything but weariness.
"Don't," he said. "Don't you dare."
She met his eyes. I had never seen such gentle pain on her face.
"You're running a fever, Donald, please. You should be in bed."
He laid his head on the rug and closed his eyes.
It doesn't matter.
Donald?
It doesn't matter, he repeated dully.
Anastasia started crying in silence. She stayed next to Morgan, stroking her hand over his mottled silver and brown hair. An hour later, Morgan was unconscious in bed again. Molly was down in the lab, pretending to work on potions with the trap door closed. I was sitting in the same spot with an empty can of Coke. Anastasia came out of the bedroom and shut the door silently behind her. Then she leaned back against it.
When I saw him, she said, I thought he had come here to hurt you, that he had learned about the two of us and wanted to hurt you.
You, I asked, and Morgan? She was quiet for a moment before she said,
I never allowed it to happen. It wasn't fair to him,
but he wanted it anyway, I said. She nodded.
Hell's bells, I sighed.
She folded her arms over her stomach, never looking up.
Was it any different with your apprentice, Harry?
Molly hadn't always been the grasshopper she was today. When I'd first begun teaching her, she'd assumed that I would be teaching her all sorts of things that had nothing to do with magic and everything to do with her being naked. And that had been more than all right with her. Just not with me.
Not much, I acknowledged. But he hasn't been your apprentice for a long, long time.
I have always been of the opinion that romantic involvement was a vulnerability I could not afford, not in my position.
Not always, I said, apparently.
She exhaled slowly.
It was a much easier opinion to hold in my previous body. It was older, less prone to...
life, I suggested.
She shrugged. Desire, loneliness, joy, pain.
Life, I said.
Perhaps.
She closed her eyes for a moment.
When I was young, I reveled in love, Harry, in passion, in discovery, and in new experiences, and in life.
She gestured down at herself.
I never realized how much of it I'd forgotten until Corpse Taker left me like this.
She opened her pained eyes and looked at me. I didn't realize how much I missed it until you reminded me.
And by then, Morgan wasn't...
He was like I had been, detached.
In other words, I said, he'd made himself more like you,
patterned himself after you. And because he'd done that, after your change, he wasn't capable of giving you what you wanted.
She nodded. I shook my head. 100 years is a long time to carry a torch, I said. That one must burn like hell.
I know. And I never wanted to hurt him. You must believe me.
Here's where you say the heart wants what the heart wants, I said.
Trite, she said, but true, all the same.
She turned until her right shoulder leaned on the door, facing me.
We should talk about where this leaves us.
I toyed with the can of Coke.
Before we can do that, I said, we have to talk about Morgan and Lafortier.
She exhaled slowly.
Yes.
What do you intend to do? I asked.
He's wanted by the council, Harry, she said in a gentle voice. I don't know how he's managed to avoid being located by magical means, but sooner or later, in hours or days, he will be found. And when that happens, you and Molly will be implicated as well. You'll both die with him. She took a deep breath. And if I don't go to the council with what I know, I'll be right there beside you.
Yeah, I said.
You really think he's innocent? She asked.
Of Lafortier's murder, I said.
Yes.
Do you have proof?
I found out enough to make me think I'm right. Not enough to clear him, yet.
If it wasn't Morgan, she said quietly, then the traitor is still running around loose.
Yeah.
You're asking me to discard the pursuit of a suspect with strong evidence supporting his guilt in favor of chasing a damn ghost, Harry. Someone we've barely been able to prove exists, much less identify.
Not only that, you're asking me to gamble your life, your apprentice's life,
and my own against finding this ghost in time.
Yes, I am.
She shook her head. Everything I've ever learned as a warden tells me that it's far more likely that Morgan is guilty.
Which brings us back to the question, I said. What are you going to do?
Silence yawned. She pushed off the door and came to sit down on the chair facing my seat on the couch.
All right, she said. Tell me everything.
Chapter 24.
This is not how diplomacy is done, Anastasia said as we approached the Chateau Wraith.
You're in America now, I said. Our idea of diplomacy is showing up with a gun in one hand and a sandwich in the other and asking which you'd prefer.
Anastasia's mouth curved up at one corner.
You brought a sandwich? Who do I look like, Kissinger? I'd been to the Chateau Wraith before, but it had always been at night, or at least twilight. It was an enormous estate, most of an hour away from Chicago proper, a holding of House Wraith, the current ruling house of the White Court. The chateau itself was surrounded by at least half a mile of old-growth forest that had been converted to an idyllic, even garden-like state, like you sometimes see on centuries-old European properties. Huge trees and smooth grass beneath them dominated, with the occasional suspiciously symmetrical outgrowth of flowering plants, often located in the center of golden shafts of sunlight that came down through the green-shadowed trees at regular intervals. The grounds were surrounded by a high fence topped with razor wire that couldn't be readily seen from the outside. The fence was electrically charged, too, and the latest surveillance cameras, seemingly little more than glass beads with wires running out of them, monitored every inch of the exterior. At night, it made for one extremely creepy piece of property. On a bright summer afternoon, it just looked pretty. Very, very wealthy and very, very pretty. Like the wraiths themselves, the grounds were only scary when seen at the right time. A polite security guard with the general bearing of ex-military had watched us get out of a cab, called ahead, and let us in with hardly a pause. We'd walk past the gate and up the drive through Little Sherwood until we reached the chateau proper.
How good are her people? Anastasia asked.
I'm sure you've read the file.
Yes, she said, as we started up the steps, but I prefer your personal assessment.
Since Laura's taken over the hiring, I said, they've improved significantly. I don't think they're fed upon to keep them under control anymore.
And you base that assessment upon what?
I shrugged. The before and after. The last batch of hired muscle was just out of touch, willing to die at a moment's notice, but not exactly the sharpest tacks in the box. Pretty and vacant, and pretty vacant. I gestured back at the entrance. That guy back there had a newspaper nearby, and he was eating lunch when we showed up. Before, they just stood around like mannequins with muscle. I'm betting that most of them are ex-military, the hardcore kind, not the get-my-college-funded kind.
Officially, she said, as we reached the top of the steps, they remain untested.
Or maybe Lara's just smart enough not to show them off until it's necessary to use them, I said.
Officially, Anastasia said dryly, she remains untested.
You didn't see her killing super ghouls with a couple of knives the way I did during the White Court coup, I said. I rapped on the door with my staff and adjusted the hang of my gray cloak. I know my word isn't exactly respected among the old guard wardens, but take it from me. Lara Wraith is one smart and scary bitch.
Anastasia shook her head with a faint smile.
And yet you're here to hold a gun to her head.
I'm hoping that if we apply some pressure, we'll get something out of her, I said. I'm low on options, and I don't have time to be anything but direct.
Well, she said, at least you're playing to your strengths.
A square-jawed, flat-topped man in his 30s opened the door. He was wearing a casual beige sports suit, accessorized by a gun in a shoulder holster, and what was probably a Kevlar vest beneath his white tee. If that wasn't enough, he had some kind of dangerous-looking little machine gun hanging from a nylon strap over one shoulder.
Sir, he said with a polite nod. Ma'am, may I take your cloaks?
Thank you, Anastasia said. But they're part of the uniform. If you could convey us directly to Ms. Wraith, that would be most helpful.
The security man nodded his head. Before you accept the hospitality of the house,
I would ask you both to give me your personal word that you are here in good faith and will offer no violence while you are a guest." Anastasia opened her mouth, as if she intended to readily agree, but I stepped slightly in front of her and said, "Hell no." The security man narrowed his eyes and looked a little less relaxed. "Excuse me? Go tell Lara that whether or not we rip this house to splinters and broken glass is still up for debate," I said. "Tell her there's already blood on the floor, and I think some of it is on her hands. Tell her if she wants a chance to clear the air, she talks to me. Tell her if she doesn't, that it is answer enough, and that she accepts the consequences." The guard stared at me for several seconds. Then he said, "You got a real high opinion of yourself. Do you know what's around you? Do you have any idea where you're standing?" "Yeah," I said. "Ground zero." More silence stretched, and he blinked before I did. "I'll tell her. Wait here, please." I nodded to him, and he walked deeper into the house. "Ground zero?" Anastasia muttered out of the corner of her mouth. "A trifle melodramatic, don't you think?" I answered her in a similar fashion. "I was going to go with 3 feet from where they'll find your body, but I figured that would have made it too personal. He's just doing his job." She shook her head. "Is there some reason this can't be a civil visit?" "Lara's at her most dangerous when everyone's being civil," I said. "She knows it. I don't want her feeling comfortable. It'll be easier to get answers out of her if she's worried about all hell breaking loose."
"It might also be easier to question her if we aren't worried about it," Anastasia pointed out. "She does hold the advantage here. One notes that there is fairly fresh plaster on the walls on either side of us, for instance."
I checked. She was right. "So?"
"So, if I was the one preparing to defend this place, I think I might line the walls with anti-personnel mines, wired to a simple charge, and cover them in plaster until I needed them to remove a threat too dangerous to engage directly. I'd personally seen what an AP mine could do to human bodies. It wasn't pretty. Imagine what's left of a squirrel when it gets hit with large rounds from a heavy-gauge shotgun. There's not much there but scraps and stains. It's essentially the same when a human gets hit with a load of ball bearings the size of gumballs that spew from an AP mine." I glanced at either wall again.
"At least I was right," I said. "Ground zero." Anastasia smiled faintly.
"I just thought I'd mention the possibility. There's a fine line between audacity and idiocy."
"And if she thinks she's in danger, Lara might just detonate them now," I said. "Preemptive self-defense."
"Mm-hmm. Generally the favored method for dealing with practitioners. The customs of hospitality would have protected us from her as much as her from us."
I thought about that for a second and then shook my head. "If we were all calm and polite, she'd never give away anything. And she won't kill us, not until she finds out what we know." She shrugged.
"You could be right. You've dealt with the smart, scary bitch more often than me."
"I guess we'll know in a minute." A minute later, we were still there, and the security guy reappeared. "This way, please," he said. We followed him through the wealthy splendor of the house. Hardwood floors, custom-carved woodworking, statues, fountains, suits of armor, original paintings, one of them of Van Gogh, stained glass windows, household staff in formal uniform. I kept expecting to come across a flock of peacocks roaming the halls, or maybe a pet cheetah in a diamond-studded collar. After a goodly hike, the guard led us to a wing of the house that had apparently been converted to corporate office space. There were half a dozen efficient-looking people working in cubicles. A phone with a digital ringtone chirruped in the background. Copiers wheezed. In the background, a radio played soft rock. We went past the office, down a short hall, past a break room that smelled of fresh coffee, and to the double doors at the end of the hallway. The guard held open one of the doors for us, and we went inside, to an outer office, complete with a secretary's desk, manned by a stunning young woman. By Justine, in fact, her white hair held back in a tail, wearing a conservative gray pantsuit. As we entered, she rose with a polite, impersonal smile that could have taken any number of competitive pageants.
"Sir, ma'am, if you'll come this way, please. Ms. Wraith is ready to see you."
She went over to the door on the wall behind her desk, knocked once, and opened it enough to say,
"Ms. Wraith, the wardens are here."
A very soft, feminine voice answered her. Justine opened the door all the way and held it for us, smiling. "Coffee, sir, ma'am? Another beverage?" "No, thank you," Anastasia said as we entered. Justine shut the door carefully behind us. Lara Wraith's office had a few things in common with Evelyn Derrick's. It had the same rich furnishings, though her style was more rich, dark hardwood than glass, the same clarity of function and purpose. The resemblance ended there. Lara's office was a working office. Mail was stacked neatly on a corner of the desk. Files and envelopes each had their own specific positions upon her desk and the work table against one wall. A pen and ink set was in evidence on the desktop. Paperwork anarchy threatened the room, but order had been strongly imposed, guided by an obvious will. Lara Wraith, de facto ruler of the White Court, sat behind the desk. She wore a silk business suit of purest white, cut close to the flawless lines of her body. The cut of the suit elegantly displayed her figure and contrasted sharply with the long, blue-black hair, which hung in waves past her shoulders. Her features had the classically immortal beauty of Greek statues, balancing sheer beauty with strength, intelligence, and perception. Her eyes were a deep, warm gray, framed by thick, sooty lashes, and just looking at her full, soft mouth made my lips twitch and tingle as they demanded an introduction to Lara's. "Warden Dresden," she murmured, her voice soothing and musical. "Warden Lucio, please be seated." I didn't need to check with Anastasia. Both of us just stood there, staff in hand, regarding her quietly. She leaned back in her chair, and a wicked little smile played over that mouth, without ever getting as far as her eyes. "I see. I'm being intimidated. Are you going to tell me why, or do I get three guesses?" "Stop being cute, Lara," I said. "Your lawyer, Evelyn Derrick, hired a private eye to tail me and report on my movements, and every time I turn around, something nasty has shown up to make a run at me." The smile remained in place. "Lawyer?" "I took a look at her head," I said, "and found the marks of the White Court all over it, including a compulsion not to reveal who she was working for."
"And you think it was my doing?" she asked.
"In these parts?" I asked. "Why not?"
"I'm hardly the only member of the White Court in the region, Dresden," Lara said. "And while I'm flattered that you think so highly of me, the others of my kind do not love me so well as to consult with me before every action they take."
Anastasia stepped in.
"But they wouldn't engage the White Council in this sort of business without your approval," she smiled. "Such a thing would be seen as a challenge to the authority of the White King."
Lara studied Lucio for a while, gray eyes probing.
"Captain Lucio," she said, "I saw you dance in Naples."
Anastasia frowned.
"It would have been, what, 2 centuries ago, give or take a few decades?" Lara smiled. "You were exquisitely gifted. Granted, that was before your current condition."
"Ms. Wraith," Anastasia said, "that is hardly germane to the subject at hand."
"It could be," Lara murmured. "You and I attended the same party after your performance. I know the sort of appetites you indulged back then."
Her lips curled into a hungry little smile, and it was suddenly all I could do to keep my knees from buckling in sheer, sudden, irrational sexual desire.
"Perhaps you'd care to revisit old times," Lara purred.
And as quickly as that, the desire was gone. Anastasia took a slow, deep breath.
"I'm too old to be amused by such antics, Ms. Wraith," she replied calmly,
"just as I'm too intelligent to believe that you don't know something of what's been happening in Chicago." It took me a couple of seconds to pull my mind back from the places Lara had just sent it, but I managed.
"We know you're working with someone inside the council," I said quietly. "I want you to tell us who it is. And I want you to release Thomas."
Lara's eyes snapped to me on that last.
"Thomas?"
I leaned on my staff and watched her face closely. Thomas managed to warn me about the hitman Evelyn Derrick had directed to me, but he disappeared before he could get involved.
He's not answering either of his phones, and no one at the salon has seen him either. Lara's eyes went distant for a moment, and a frown line marred the perfection of her brow.
Is that all you have, Dresden? A fading psychic impression that one of